Howdy and welcome to River Talk, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, we're lucky enough to have a great guest, Emerald LaFortune, Executive Director of the Red Sign Foundation, who we're going to interview. But as always, we'd like to start off with News of the Week. So, Zach, Priscilla, what do you have for News of the Week?
My only news is that Boatsmith is becoming a pretty big deal. Boatsmith is the new festival on the Smith River in California, and it's just 2 weeks away, and it seems like it's going to be huge. So I can't make it, I don't think, but I think everybody who can make it's getting pretty excited about it.
Do you have the dates on that, Zach?
It's President's Day weekend, whatever that is. I think it's like February 16th or something like that. It's two weekends away. Yeah, it's right around the corner. And it used to be, when I was in college, we used to go up there and just do our own little, you know, every year is an annual event to go President's Day weekend and go paddle. And it's a great weekend to go. There's usually good water and it's miserably cold and rainy, but everything's flowing. And so, and it's going to be a really well-organized event. So I'm pretty excited they're doing it. I'm kind of bummed I can't make it.
Yeah. Cool. My news is from, Oregon specific legislation for the long legislative session, which started last week. We have a lot of stuff that is of interest to the general recreation conservation community, but there's three bills that are really, of particular interest to boaters and folks that enjoy whitewater, and river access. So we have, House Bill 2835, which is a waterway access bill that has been dreamed up by a fellow that I've been working with outside of the Portland area that's really just a water access advocate for families and communities. Myself, Representative Helm, a group called Oregon Outdoors and American Whitewater. So what the bill does is it codifies the public trust doctrine that basically says that all Oregonians have a right to access to navigate waterways, and also introduces a section about portage rights, and also directs the Department of State Parks and Recreation to inventory public access, which is a cool thing to do just so that the public can know more of how much access we have, what's been closed, what's been opened. And it also introduces a public closure process for anything over 30 days. So it's a pretty cool bill. There's a lot in it and there's a lot of work to be done to get it passed, but that's what I'll be doing for the next few months.
Cool.
And then we have the Marine Board bill that we talked about on some earlier podcast and has a lot of chatter around it, which establishes a waterway access account and charges a fee to boaters with boats over 10 feet. And that's Senate Bill 47.
Sorry to interrupt, Doc. This one's important. I think this one's very controversial among certain groups. And I think a lot of private boaters are annoyed they have to pay a fee to paddle. Do you want to make the case for why private boaters should pay a fee to paddle?
Sure. So I think it was last year, last long legislative session, myself and a number of other boaters that could showed up to the public hearing for the first introduction of this bill and opposed it in written and oral testimony because it was basically just charging anyone with a craft used to float rivers, aside from inner tubes and floaty animals, to float the river, and just felt pretty against that. It's like the same thing as taxing hiking boots, and it wasn't really justified. So after, and I know that you and I know for sure Eric has worked with the Marine Board for a number of years on figuring out a way to help fund non-motorized activities and grants and infrastructure without overtaxing outfitters and boaters or just putting a tax on accessing rivers. So there's that feedback that was put in. And we also basically said in this public hearing last year, like, leave whitewater paddlers or whitewater kayakers out of it, because people that have, you know, whitewater kayaks specifically are the least likely to use built structures, boat ramps, bathrooms, that sort of thing. Like, they're pretty self-sufficient. So they did listen to us, and that's how they came up with the 10-foot and longer rule in their waterway access account. And, you know, based on numbers of surveys over the years, over and over again, folks say they want more access to waterways, they want more toilets, they want more trailheads, they want more stairs, and they want things that are more family friendly, you know, elderly population friendly, disabled folks friendly. And so they came up with this bill that charges $17 a year, $30 every 2 years, or I believe, I can't remember what the single day, I think $7 for a single day pass if you wanted to do it that way. If you have a boat 10 feet or longer, a transferable permit that will help fund under-realized grant requests specifically for non-motorized projects. So like, you know, building a trail or, you know, an stuff that exists like on the Clackamas on the Rogue, like Cog Creek Boat Landing is an example of like a really big project. Where some of the access points on the Clackamas are merely just a set of stairs. It also helps to fund educational programs, community outreach programs, and what's really cool is it will help fund land acquisitions for non-motorized boater access, which is a really big positive for us in terms of just, at least in the Willamette Valley, we're often seeing closures due to discrepancies between public ownership and private ownership. And if you're able to have an agency that advocates for those access points and has the ability to acquire land specifically to serve non-motorized boater access to waterways, I think that's a big win. And, you know, like $30 every 2 years for a transferable permit seems like a good way to do that, even if you're someone like myself that probably won't really use built facilities all that often.
So this is for the typical private, I mean, the people paying for this are rafters because kayakers are under 10 feet usually, unless you have a green boat or something. So
yeah,
rafters or long IKers are paying this fee to go boating, and what they're getting in return is improved access.
Correct. Yeah.
And the question I keep hearing from people is, how do we know this money is going to go to access and not to paying a Marine Board, just regular, you know, they're not just going to take the money and use it for administrative things or just increase their budget. How do we know it's going to get used correctly? Because I think there's a history in Oregon and other places of things like, or even federally. A good example is the salmon plate fee. I have one of those salmon Oregon State plates. And it turns out all that money was just being used for administration. None of it was used for restoration like it was supposed to.
Yeah.
So how do we know that this money, if we all pay these fees, actually ends up going into these projects to increase river access?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's always kind of an element of trust there. And, you know, from a budgetary standpoint and like a rules standpoint of the agency, they're directed to use this money in a very specific way. And it is limited on how much money can be spent on administrative costs. I can't remember. I remember asking them that same question, and they laid out all the rules for if this fund, you know, when you set up a fund for an agency, there's very specific rules as to where the income can be spent. So they're setting it up in a way that encourages good use of it. Of course, right now I'm really happy with the new leadership with the Marine Board, and they seem extraordinarily invested in serving us. And, you know, every time I've asked for them to set up a meeting with voters to answer questions, or anytime I have a concern, they're always picking up the phone, they're always responding, they're always following up immediately. If that leadership changes, of course, that might change. But I think the second part of this story is that if you continue to have voters showing up and kind of making it so that they're really accountable for their work, they're going to have a lot of incentive to do good for the people that are constantly knocking on their door and calling them. And I think in the past, the interface of non-motorized boaters in the Marine Board has been pretty limited, aside from some committees made of like guides and outfitters to direct them to come up with ideas like this. So,
well, I don't just, guides and outfitters didn't come up with this idea. I want to be really clear. I don't think this came from guides and outfitters.
Well, components of the bill did come from the strategic work group that the Marine Board had a number of years ago that
there was guides and outfitters on that board, but they were, I think, like, there was one other commercial guy on that board out of, you know, like 20 people. I mean, it was, we had a voice at the table, but we were by far the minority voice at the table.
Yeah.
And I don't think that guides and outfitters are pushing for this. I don't want private boaters to get mad at us. Like, hey, we want these fees. Cause I don't think this is coming from outfitters. This is coming from.
Oh no, no. Yeah. I'm just saying that they took feedback from those work groups and from public comment and, you know, revised what their original proposal was, which their original proposal, everyone hated, including myself. I was super, super against it. So the feedback they got was from non-motorized boaters, and they tried to do what they could to serve our interests. So I think, you know, if this does pass, and that's a big if, something that folks in the community need to know is, like, this type of service is only going to go as far as advocacy in the community extends. If nobody's showing up and asking for things to be done and holding folks accountable and you know, creating these conversations where there's partnership between non-motorized voters and the agency, then there's not going to be a lot of incentive or reward for them to actually do the things that we want to. And it can't just be me, like, meeting with them every week and telling them what I want. It has to be the whole community, so to speak. So I think that's something to keep in mind with any of these types of bills and with any agencies. Like, Whitewater voters are largely not present in a lot of these meetings and conversations. And if we were, it would completely change the conversation and how these agencies serve us.
Yeah. Well, I think on that, there is an important point in that note, though, that this bill doesn't affect Whitewater kayakers. In that you're not going to pay into the system. So, you know, ultimately there's also needs to be an expectation of when you come to things, wanting things that are going to, you know, just serve the Whitewater kayaking community, that because you don't pay into the system, there's probably a reality of, you know, how high up the list you'll be on getting resources. But exactly. I feel like the chatter I've seen online has been a ton of people from the Whitewater community, like the Whitewater kayaking community, mm-hmm. which this bill ultimately doesn't really impact.
Correct.
You know, and there's this fear of sort of like eventually it is going to. And I don't, from my conversations with Marine Board and stuff, I think that's pretty unfounded. I think they recognize after the last battle and also, you know, with what they did with the invasive species, that if they're going to start putting fees on people with boats under 10 feet long, like, that's a battle they're not going to win.
Yeah, they know that.
I don't think they have any interest in fighting that fight. No. So, you know, if you're just a whitewater kayaker, I really don't think there's a whole lot of justification in getting up in arms over this thing.
Yeah. But paddling, like, non-motorized paddlers should be involved in this. And, you know, if you do multiple types of crafts, be involved, have an opinion, and start talking to folks. But yeah, it's super accurate. Whitewater paddlers are really not going to be affected by this unless you have a long boat that you're going to.
Rafters will definitely be.
Whitewater kayakers with normal creek boats will not be.
And I think your point about going to meetings is a good one. The last meeting I went to, there were three of us, and Eric was on the phone, so there's four really. And I had drugged one person there. You know, I think it was on a Tuesday at 10. And my job allows me to go to meetings on Tuesdays. But the average Whitewater boater, you know, doesn't have the ability to drive to Salem. And they don't want, even if it was in the evening, they don't want to take their evening to go meet with the Marine Board. They just want to go boat. So I think it's hard to expect the average paddler to go to these meetings. I think some of us can because we have the ability to, and this is our job. But I don't think the Marine Board's going to be able to have meetings of people and expect a strong turnout to advocate for more things.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they did have a number. Yeah, they definitely need to do outreach better and maybe do more evening meetings, but.
Or go to where
paddlers So that first meeting that you guys are talking about, that was probably my fault for the timing, but they indicated that there was a big meeting of a bunch of outfitters right before or right after.
No, that was great.
It was right after the outfitters.
And that was just an outfitter meeting. And there was three
and
of us.
And that was why we scheduled it for 10 a.m. It was so that folks that were out of town could show up in person and they could call in on a conference line. But so the fact that one person called in on the conference line says a lot more to me than the number of people that showed up in person. If you can't, you know, if you can't call into a conference line for even 10 or 15 minutes or write a letter or an email or call at your own convenience, that says a lot about our community.
Yeah, it's just the average, you know, the average person's busy. They have families and kids, and it's hard to go to meetings and things. I think the Marine Board would be great if they went to, like, an Oregon Whitewater Association meeting, or if they went to maybe Clackfest and had a booth and talked to boaters.
I think that's a great idea. Come to us. I think they'd be super into that.
Instead of us coming to them. I think most the average rafter just wants to go rafting and not be regulated, not to go to meetings. You know, they want to just, you know, continue our right to go paddling unimpeded. So
that's
true. I would suggest the Marine Board, you know, I should tell them this directly, so I'll probably write them a letter myself. But
we know they listen, right? They listen to
us. I hope not, because they licensed me. I don't want to get in trouble. Anyway, I do want to, we should probably move on, but Priscilla, I want to second what you say. The leadership at the Marine Board is excellent. Like, they're good people, and they're well-intentioned, and that's an important thing to know.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to spend too much more time on this, but I think just a closing note is, like, everyone's busy, everyone has stuff to do, but when it comes down to having, like, people advocate for our access and be an ally for us when it comes to, like, dealing with closed gates or, like, easements, like, you know, quite frankly, like, you can't bitch about stuff if you're not willing to show up or make a phone call.
What's Joe's old saying there, Zach, that you always repeat?
Oh, Dick saying. Yeah, my mentor would always say, the world belongs to those who show up.
Exactly. So if you're not willing to do the, like, absolute minimum amount of work to get things moving in the direction that you want so that you can continue to float rivers without excess regulation or having to worry about getting $130 ticket for trespass because you don't know what's private and what's public, like, do the minimum amount of work. And if you have extra time, do more than that. Because a lot of people, or a very small group of people, are doing way more than the minimum and making a lot of sacrifices for the rest of the community to enjoy public waterways.
And thank you.
And then when
you
do things we don't like, when things don't like, things happen we don't like, we're going to blame you for sure. So, involved or not.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom O'Keefe.
We should probably keep going. A couple news of the week things, or last ones here. Permit season's about to end, so if you haven't applied for your permits for, you know, basically all of the BLM Forest Service rivers, the time to do that is coming to an end. So make sure you get your applications in for your summer adventures. And on our note, we just started getting our first calls about shuttles for the Illinois, so it appears Illinois season might be starting. So
awesome.
That's exciting, I guess. For those who want to go freeze their butts off down the Illinois Canyon. When
it's probably delightful right now. The weather is pretty nice.
Yeah, no, I was actually considering next weekend if I'm down there. Yeah. All right. Perfect. Quick into emails. We did get one email. Somebody on our topic of when do you not go because you forgot stuff sent a picture of them from what looks like way back in the day in some old kayak paddling without a life jacket or a helmet. You know, basically saying, like, you know, it happens to all of us. So there you have it.
I think what happened, that looks like a creek that flows into the green in Utah. I think what happened was they hiked a put in and realized they forgot their stuff and said, we'll go anyway to Low Water Creek. I'm just guessing that's the story.
I agree. That's kind of what it looks like.
And when it was low volume.
It's a great picture, though.
Yeah.
It looks like 10 CFS. Like,
it being low volume, I think that they made a judgment call. Well, it's shallow. They'll just get out if they have to.
Yeah. It's very funny. All
right. Well, so we should go to our main topic, which is talking to our guest that we have here today. Emerald LaFortune, and tell me if I butchered your last name, is the executive director of the Redside Foundation, and we'll get into what that is. But Emerald, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Awesome. So just a couple kind of quick background questions. Tell us a little bit about your guiding history and guiding experience, where how you started, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. I think there's a short story and a long story as far as that goes. So I'll try and find somewhere in between. I grew up boating in Idaho. I grew up in northern Idaho. Boating was always our summer vacation. I remember I would like beg. All I wanted to do was go to Hawaii or go to Disneyland. And my parents were like, no way. We live in Idaho. We're going rafting. So I really grew up on the water, and as I started getting into my later teenage years, we would go down to Riggins to go boating for the weekend, and I would see these river guides. And truth be told, at that age, I was a little bit boy crazy, so it's not necessarily my proudest moment, but I think part of what got me into guiding was I was like, whoa, these people are so cool. These boys are so cute with their floppy blonde hair. You know, keep in mind, I'm like 16, 17 at this point. But I also was getting into rowing and just really loved being out on the river. So about 3 days after I graduated high school, I moved to Riggins, Idaho, and I guided for a couple summers there. And in a lot of ways had a really wonderful experience and also, you know, had a tough time like I think anyone does in their first job and their first, or, you know, their first job as an adult, their first summer experiences. And I actually took a couple years off of guiding, later in college. I was going to college over at University of Montana. And I took a summer and I waitressed, and I took a summer and I was on a trail crew in the Selway Bitterroot. And then finally, right after I graduated with my undergraduate, came back to guiding after doing a Grand Canyon trip that had a few Idaho, multi-day Idaho guides on it. And they said, hey, you know, you should think about coming back to this. And I told myself I was just going to guide for one season after college before I got my career, quote unquote, back on track and took the work I had been doing with nonprofits a little more seriously. And 4 years later, I was still sort of basing my life around multi-day guiding in Idaho. So it really stuck once I found kind of the right crew and the right fit and the right culture.
Cool. Speaking of that culture, like what is it that draws you to, you know, or has kept you in kind of the guiding community and the guiding culture?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and an interesting one. I think that guiding and guiding culture is a little different for everyone, and we all come at it from different places with different priorities. So I suppose just speaking to my experience, I think that, first of all, there's just nothing like a guide. I think they're some of the most sort of vibrant, awake, passionate people that are, I think in a lot of ways, really willing to show up, like you mentioned earlier in your news, to the things that they care about. It's, you know, rivers for them, or land-based if we're talking about hunting guides. The wilderness areas or these wild places or backcountry locations aren't just places they love recreationally. They're also a source of our economy. And so I think I was really drawn to that way that guides are willing to live sort of unconventional lives in favor of doing the things they're passionate about. I think that I also, in my undergrad, was a environmental studies major, and I saw really directly the way that guides have this incredible opportunity to change the way that people think about wild rivers and the wilderness areas and remote places like Idaho. And I thought that that opportunity was really unique and interesting and one of the most effective tools for environmental education that we have. So it also connected into some of my more intellectual bases. But also I think I was really, the guiding community is so strong. The friends you make when you've been through that type of work together are really special, and I think that kept me coming back as well.
Awesome.
Great. You know, before we get into, you know, Red Side a little bit, I want to hear about that. One of the questions that I had, you know, is an outfitter, and, you know, I'm sort of come from a guiding background and still get to get on the river and guide a bunch and everything else. But I also sit on the other side of the equation a little bit as an outfitter. So from your perspective, like, what do you see as kind of the big issues facing the guiding community? What are the things that you kind of experience as you've now grown through guiding for a while and everything else? Like, what do you see as sort of the big issues in the guiding community?
Sure. I think that there's as many issues as there are reasons to celebrate, like most communities. And again, issues are going to vary a little bit based on if you are daily guiding, multi-day guiding, if you're working on a crew, if you're working solo. I know sometimes from my past experiences, I get into sort of the channel of, oh yeah, guiding is river guiding with crews and boathouses, and I have to take a step back and remember guiding is a lot of different things. In a place like Idaho and in the West as a whole, you have people who are independent contractors working solo. You have all remote camps out in the wilderness for hunting season. So I think that issues vary based on context, but I think overall some of the issues that we see in the guiding community are that we do end up being really different. We have these small, you know, maybe 5-10 people communities of guides that we know well, maybe more like 20-25 if you live in a hub like Riggins or Stanley. Mm-hmm. But that as a community and as an industry, we're really spread out. Some of that's the geography of a place like Idaho. Some of that is that we prefer to be on the river in the wilderness rather than attending meetings or hanging out in town. But I do think sometimes that leads to the community feeling sort of spread out, and so you don't necessarily get the benefits that communities bring as well. I think we see a lot of issues with guides when they get to an end of a season and you've sort of built this little nuclear family that takes care of each other. And then all of a sudden the season's over and one person's in Colorado and one person's in Chile and another is back home in Ohio. And because guides, generalized, don't necessarily love spending time on email or on the phone or tied to their computers, I think people can feel sort of lonely and ungrounded during those times. And you also have the issues of things like, you know, for those who want to really guide long term, oftentimes employers aren't setting up retirement accounts or helping you navigate health insurance, or, you know, there's no paid time off if you're injured for a season. So I think that it's definitely a non-traditional workplace that comes with a lot of awesome benefits and also some real risks when it comes to taking care of ourselves and taking care of our community as a whole. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great. And I think that really leads into the next question of, give us a little background on what the Red Side Foundation is.
Sure. So the Red Side Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit, and the mission is to support the health and strength of Idaho's guiding community. And the organization was founded in 2010 under sad circumstances of losing a longtime Middle Fork of the Salmon River guide to suicide. So the Idaho community sort of came together after that event and really started looking at what they could do to better support community and support guides within the state. And actually modeled off of the Whale Foundation, which is a Grand Canyon River Guide organization that does similar work for Grand Canyon River Guides. And up in Idaho, they decided to not just serve river guides, but think of guiding and guides as a whole, whether they be fly fishing guides, hiking guides, hunting guides, ATV guides, any outdoor guide in the state sort of falls under the umbrella of who the Red Side Foundation serves. And I think that that was a very explicit decision that the original founding members made. the Red Side Foundation was all volunteer board run until 2016. And then in 2016, I came on as their first staff member, which I think is a really, you know, besides being a really fun, wonderful, engaging, rewarding job for me, it's cool to see that the community really has rallied around and supported Red Side to the point where they can have that type of paid services they provide.
Oh, I think we're losing Emerald.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, now you're back.
Okay, sorry. Does that answer your question about what Red Side does?
Yeah. So, go ahead, Zach.
I have a question. What's the biggest thing that Red Side does? Is it mental health for guides? Is it there's a suicide prevention hotline? What's like the number one thing that Red Side provides?
Sure. So our cornerstone and the thing I know that is our sort of non-negotiable, our number one priority to always keep running is what we call the Red Side Foundation Guide Helpline. And that is really our mental and emotional support section of our services. And the way we've set that up to work is that we actually have a licensed professional counselor based out of Boise who contracts and works for us. And she mans a helpline where guides can call. It's a completely free and confidential service. They call, can open a case with her, tell her a little bit about what they are experiencing, going through, navigating. And then she helps set them up with a provider in their area, whether that be Idaho or Washington or Ohio or anywhere across the country or world that they may find themselves during that particular time period. And then Red Side pays for up to 8 sessions with that provider.
Wow.
So that cornerstone is really trying to remove the financial and logistical barriers from guides accessing mental health and emotional health support. So for some guides, that might look like going to a licensed professional counselor. For some guides, that might look like a 12-step substance abuse program. She's really able, as a professional in her field and a former guide, to help guides navigate what type of resources are most relevant to them and what they're going through.
And so that's that phone, if they call that phone number, it goes to her, not like the Red Side office.
Yep. Yeah, it goes to her. It's important that I think for guides to feel like their issues aren't, you know, such a tight-knit community that a lot of us know people who are on the board, a lot of guides know me. And so if people call or text that number, it's going straight to her. And then we get basic demographic information for the board and for myself to understand how the services are being used. But their names are being kept private. What they're navigating is kept private. And it's under her, you know, she's a medical professional. So she's keeping their case private as well.
Is this only open to Idaho guides?
You know, we frame as Idaho guides just because at some point you do need to put some parameters on things. With that said, we recognize that a lot of our neighboring guiding communities, whether that's Wyoming, whether that's Montana, Washington, Oregon, don't have services like this. So oftentimes if those guides do call or access the helpline, we take a look at where our budget is for the year, make sure that we feel comfortable that we have enough in our budget to continue to support Idaho guides, and then can offer some connections and services to guides outside the state. We also encourage folks to think about starting similar organizations in their state or regions or guiding communities as well.
It's a big project to start an organization like that. This has been a long time in the making, and I don't know how many people are going to start these in Oregon or Wyoming or other places. Would Red Side ever expand its scope and be more of like river guiding in the West? Or do you think it will always be an Idaho-based organization?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing to consider, especially from the framework of nonprofit management. I think that I could never, as executive director, I could never tell you just from my perspective whether we would do that or not. That's definitely thing that we use that board of directors for when we start thinking about shifting focus, shifting mission. I know the conversation certainly comes up, though, because we do get calls, not just from the West, but from people in Maine, from people in North Carolina who have found RedSide and are wondering how it's set up, how it's funded, how it's organized. So it's certainly on our radar. I'd say our last conversation, the board was still pretty invested in making sure that we were serving Idaho Guides fully and completely before we started to think about really making any sort of moves towards expansion. If that's a nice, vague politician answer for you.
Noncommittal.
Yeah. I just know what you guys do is really important, and we do trips here in Oregon, and long term, I would love to see that. I'd love to see RedSide be bigger personally, because I know you guys do important work.
Thank you.
So, but beyond the mental health services, which I take as like the most important focus or the primary focus, what other things do RedSide do?
Sure. So I think that anytime you talk about mental and emotional health, it's important to think about all the different things that are intertwined with that. I think it's my personal opinion is that health doesn't exist in a vacuum. So your mental emotional health is often tied to your financial health, which is tied to your greater sense of community, tied to your feeling of opportunity when it comes to education and training. So RedSide tries to really serve all those different parts of what it means to be a healthy guide. We do education scholarships for guides who are attending university, college, trade school. We do training grants for guides who are, you know, taking swift water rescue training or doing a packing clinic or getting their wilderness first responder or wilderness first aid. And we also do a lot of general community building across the state. So a lot of my work ends up being organizing to just try to get guides into the same room, into the same get-together, build connections between guides who work for different outfitters, and really create some language and camaraderie around this very shared experience that we all have of being a guide, whether you're day guiding in Riggins or hunt guiding in the Frank Church out of Salmon or, you know, multi-day guiding or fish guiding. They're different, but we have so many commonalities that trying to make sure the guiding community is starting to feel like a cohesive unit, I think is really important to sort of the pride that we can take in guiding and our feelings of community health as a whole.
Do most of these issues exist mainly because of the seasonality, or are there other factors? I know you mentioned how tight the community is, but are there other factors beyond the seasonality and working with a tight community?
I think that guiding, I mean, yes, putting your finger on them is always tough and varies from person. I think that guiding tends to attract risk takers in a lot of ways. And so anytime you have a community as a whole that's more willing to take risks, you also, you know, you have the incredible benefit of those risks when the risks pay off and go well. And you also have the crash landings when those risks don't work out as planned. You know, that's everything from ignoring that tweak in your shoulder and not going to the doctor to maybe waiting to figure out what your winter housing situation is until the very last minute because you're sure you're willing to take the risk that it'll all work out once you get there. And again, I don't mean to say that's not also a really beautiful part about the guiding industry. But I think it's one that we can acknowledge and mitigate the impact of.
Yeah, no, it helps. Yeah. Eric, did you have a question? Did I interrupt you?
No, it's more or less kind of the same thing.
And I would love to know what, because all three of you spend time around guides and in these guiding communities, what are the heightened risks, or have been guides for that matter, what are the heightened risks that you see in your communities?
I think for me, the like post season depression and not having like your family the rest of the year, especially for like when I was doing the majority of my guiding outside in Riggins, like I'd live there for the summer and then go back to school like most people for the rest of the 9 months. And I just remember like my guiding family in Riggins was really like a family. And every time I came back to school, I just felt like I was in this place that wasn't really a group of people that I could relate to in a lot of ways. And that was hard. And I think that resonated a lot with me. And, a lot of other guides I know struggled with that. Maybe more, I think females maybe struggle with that a bit more, just because I think for some of us, like having those close-knit groups is maybe more important. I don't know if that's an overgeneralization, but I feel like in some of the conversations I've had with female guides versus male guides, it seems to be more talked about with female guides of being like, I really miss my family during the rest of the year, or, you know, it's really hard to go through 9 months of school with people that, you know, aren't really river guides. And it's hard to explain, like, to someone that's never experienced that, like, why you're missing that. It's like, oh, well, why do you want to go on the river? Like, it's cold or whatever. And I think, like, you know, the substance abuse component of guiding is a really important thing that's overlooked. And I don't think that's unique to guiding. I think that is just something in our society that is often an overlooked thing for young people, is, you know, you're kind of have this expectation to have like a coming of age where you do all these things, and people overlook how impactful that might be to the future of your life and like your healthy habits and emotional stability and psychological stability in the long run. And that's certainly something that in the past has been perpetuated by guiding culture, not just in the water, but, you know, rock climbing, ski guiding, all those sorts of things. So it's nice to have an organization that is mindful of that and is helping guides work through that, knowing that, like, you know, when you live in a close community, it's really hard to break those community habits. And I think those two things really stood out to me, and I can certainly have some personal experiences with that and kind of working through it without a support system.
I think the alcoholism is the thing I see the most, and the biggest thing I worry about with guides in terms of them doing their job well and also their own personal health.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with those. The things I think about with the guiding community are kind of twofold, and, well, outside of the alcoholism one, you know, which Zach and I've talked about a lot, the sort of duality of life when you're a guide. There's sort of this like guiding part of your life, and then there's kind of the real world part of your life. Because when you're guiding, it's all encompassing. It's all you're doing. If you're on, you know, like a Middle Fork crew or Maine Salmon crew, I mean, you're literally either on the river or driving to or from the river almost every single hour of every single day for, you know, months and months on end. And so it's this all encompassing thing. And then it just sort of ends and you go back into the real world, and maybe, you know, for a variety of reasons, like, that's really challenging. So I think that part is tough. And then the other thing that, you know, as I've been around this longer and longer, I see more and more is kind of this challenge of being a young person, getting into guiding as a college kid or just post-college or whatever, and not, how to frame this, like, I'm of the mindset that, with, you know, some exceptions to this, but as a general rule, like when it comes to river guiding, I tell all of our young guides, like, this should be a thing that you do for a while, before you probably move on to something else that is more sustainable physically and financially and everything else. And I feel like I've seen a shift of people wanting to make river guiding like a lifelong career without stepping into, you know, management or ownership or whatever. And I, you know, there's people that make it work and that's great. But, you know, to kind of your point earlier about like the physicality of it and everything else, I have a really hard time seeing that be long-term sustainable. And I've seen a lot of people end up later in life, you know, with incredible memories and incredible experiences and all of those things, but pretty financially strapped and physically beat and all of those, you know, all of those things being true as well. And that can be hard to see.
Yeah.
I think those are all such important points from sort of thinking about the way that alcohol and substance integrates with guiding into thinking about, is this a long-term career? And I think for the folks, you know, we're really learning, especially in a place like Idaho, we're just seeing our first generation, you know, maybe second generation of guides who are 60, 70, 75 years old and still guiding, or that has been their life path. And I think learning from their experiences, when people are real adamant about wanting guiding to be a long-term answer for their career, I always just encourage them to also, you know, to then take it seriously, take it as their profession, you know, have a plan for that season where their shoulder goes out and they need to rehab, have a plan so that they can retire when they're done, and also to think really hard about how they're going to maintain their relationships, what they're going to do throughout those guiding months so they can stay connected to, you know, parents, family, brothers, sisters, girlfriends, boyfriends, et cetera. Because I do think there are things you can do. Like both my partner and I guide in the summer, and he and I have gotten really adamant about making sure that we have 1 or 2 weeks off every summer together that line up. And that's sort of this little self-care thing we do to make sure that we don't get to September, October feeling like we don't know each other, which, you know, is fun too because you have all these adventures to share with each other, but I think can be really isolating. Yeah. And on the alcohol side of things, I think there's, I think it obviously ties in with our mental and emotional health. And I think it was interesting your point, Priscilla, about the way that you've heard more female guides talk about, you know, missing their family and talking about that experience. And I think anytime we talk about guiding, it's interesting to think about the personality that you're expected to hold as a guide of sort of always having an answer, always knowing what to do, being strong, being in charge. And I think that can bleed into other parts of our lives. And I think it's always interesting to think about, okay, are more women, you know, women access our Red Side helpline at a rate that doesn't match their presence in our Idaho guiding community. They're half, if not more than half of those that use our helpline. And it's interesting for me to think about, okay, is that because women are having a tougher time in this guiding industry for a variety of reasons? Or is that also tying into this really deep-seated Western culture, guiding culture of men feeling like they need to be strong, they don't admit weakness, they don't admit when they need help? And I think that alcohol ties into all of that because it becomes, you know, that is, it's like alcohol and anger, right, are the two sort of acceptable outlets for people who are expected to be in these really on point, you know, keeping people alive type of jobs. Mm-hmm. And so trying to think about the way that alcohol substitutes for sort of release of that.
Yeah. And I think as soon as I said what I said, I was like, saying it out loud, I was like, oh, this is a perfect example of how my view of the world is maybe changed a little bit by how Western expectations are put onto, you know, masculine type folks and feminine type folks is, like, I think what you're saying is definitely true. I think that there's probably plenty of, you know, plenty of male folks that feel the same way that I felt every year at the end of the season, but they didn't want to talk about it or felt like it was silly to be feeling that way or not acceptable to be feeling that way, where, you know, if you're more feminine, it's more acceptable to outwardly express those feelings to other people.
Absolutely. I think it's so neat when we have, again, the helpline's completely confidential, but occasionally people who have used it will approach me themselves, you know, and say, hey, thank you. Or like, if you want to share my story. And when those are, you know, sometimes those people are both men and women, but sometimes men, where I'm like, I would never expect that you would act this, you're putting on, and not to say that there's anyone who couldn't benefit, you know, I think those faces and shields we put on we're all humans, we're all navigating complicated, messy lives. We could all use a little bit of help. And so I hope that guys out there know that this is something that a really wide range of people access and find benefit from. And that's always sort of inspiring to my work.
Awesome. You guys have any more questions for Emerald? We're kind of running up on our time here.
I have one more quick one. Emerald, what you work with guides a lot more, and I think that I'm at the my career path where I'm less involved on that level than I used to be. And so I have a hard time self-evaluating how my job is an outfitter sometimes. And so what advice would you have for Eric and I to be better employers and to be better at keeping guides healthy?
Pay them what they're worth.
Damn it.
I know you did. I think that a lot of it is a learning process. You know, even for me, the barriers and the struggles that a 19-year-old guide on the water or in the mountains is going through is going to be different already than what I experienced when I was 19. So I think a lot of it, as an outfitter, I know how busy outfitting is. A lot of you are, you know, these small business owners, you're trying to juggle a million things at once. But making sure there's space for communication between you and your guides, making sure that you're asking and then giving the time to listen, I think is a really great way just to create more trust and understanding in that relationship. And it's something that when I've come across it with outfitters, it's been really valuable. And I think making sure that they know that there are services like the Redside Foundation, that they know there's, you know, other people out there that do what they do, that they take pride in their work. And, you know, I think it's huge as an outfitter to just tell them that you care about them and want to support them in taking care of their health, because you care about them as individuals, but also because it's ultimately good business for you to have healthy, happy guides taking care of your customers.
Yeah.
But you really rely on outfitters getting the word out to their guides about what the Redside Foundation does. And we also do a physical health center that I forgot to mention. So I'll make a plug for that. We do that every during the Idaho River Rendezvous, which I think this year is May 17th through 19th in Cascade, Idaho. And we set up a physical health fair where we do dermatology checks and dental checks and immunizations, HIV testing, massage, body mechanics, mental health information is present, health insurance information is present. It's a really fun kind of way to get some of that stuff ticked off your list before you head into a busy summer season. And it's totally free for guides.
That's awesome. Emerald, what is your guys' website where people can connect with you, donate money, that kind of stuff, help support the organization?
Sure. It's www.redsidefoundation.org. And there's information about all of our services for guides, definitely want to cruise around. We also do a financial health helpline. That's a new program for us in 2018. So you can learn more about that as well on our website. And we are funded almost entirely by outfitter business donations and small individual contributions. So I'd say that every donation really goes directly back into supporting guides here in the state.
Awesome. And Emerald, what's that phone number if we have any Idaho guides listening that need to call that mental health line?
The phone number is...
Put you on the spot.
I'll put a link in the notes to the website, too.
Yeah, typical small nonprofit. So the helpline number, the confidential Idaho Guide helpline number is 208-740-1192. And again, guides can text or call that, and it's not an emergency helpline. If you need an emergency helpline, you want to call the National or Idaho Suicide Prevention helpline or call 911. But this line is specifically for guides. It'll take you to our licensed professional counselor in Boise, and she'll get back to your, you'll just leave a voicemail or a text, and she'll return your message within 48 hours. As far as getting a hold of us at RedSide, the best way to do that is via email, emerald@redsidefoundation.org or info@redsidefoundation.org. There's also a contact form on our website. And that just helps because we're all outdoors people and people that go off the grid as well. So it helps make sure we don't miss your message.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Emerald, for joining us and for, you know, doing all that.
And
for everything you do to support, you know, the Idaho guiding community. RedSide's an incredible organization. You guys do a ton of good to support, you know, a community that's certainly near and dear to our hearts. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So our last thing we always go to is Gear of the Week. And Emerald, feel free if you have anything that you just absolutely love to jump in here. But Zach, Priscilla, you got any Gear of the Week?
Priscilla, are you still here? I know she had to leave at 10:15. Okay, so she's not going to do hers. I'll go. I have sank two drones in the Wind River. I just sank my second one a couple weeks ago. The wind is particularly hard on my drones. And I like the drones. It's like a flying, you know, a flying video camera is a pretty cool way to get perspectives of rapids and things. And it adds an extra challenge to my day. So I just bought myself a Mavic 2 drone to replace it. And they're pretty sweet. And so the technology now is amazing. It really doesn't want to hit trees. I've been trying to fly into trees on purpose, and it knows they're there. It's really easy to fly. And so for my week of flying, I'd highly recommend the Mavic 2 drone. I'm hoping it's unsinkable.
It now has collision avoidance front and back. Yeah. Whereas I think the old ones only had it in the front or something. Yeah, it's pretty cool looking.
Yeah, I have a tendency to back into things or sideways into things. That's my biggest thing. And the reason I sank the last one was it lost its GPS signal and just started flying into a wall. And so I think this one has better GPS too.
Nice. Cool. Look forward to some more video of the wind.
Yeah.
Hopefully without it ending with it going into the river.
I'm not sure I want to fly in the wind anymore because I've lost two there. I've only sank two drones and they're both on the same river. So I'm really scared of flying this one there.
Cool.
Maybe somewhere else.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I've been thinking about getting one. That's the one I was looking at. They seem awesome.
It's cool.
All right. So for my Gear of the Week is something I haven't used, but I have seen it and I find it intriguing. And I want to, I think, get my hands on one to give it a try. If you listen to this, I think I've brought up probably more than once that I really have pretty strong feelings about strapping your spare oar to the side of the raft, like in the straps where you use to attach your frame to the raft, which I see people do all the time. I think it's ridiculous because you can't get to your spare oar when you need it. And you're likely, if you slam into a wall, you'll break your oar and all that kind of stuff. So SDG makes what they call the quick draw spare oar holder. And essentially it's like a giant piece of cut out PVC plastic that sort of straps up high on your raft. So above, you know, like right up against your frame, and your spare oar sits in it. And the way it's in there, it's like one buckle. You could just, it's not going to fall off. So it's like securely on there, but really quickly you pop one buckle and you can pull your oar out and, you know, you're on the run. So it seems really cool. If you've used one, love it, or used it and hate it, feel free to email us and let us know. But from just kind of having my hands on one and getting to see it, I think it's a pretty cool, it's so far the coolest specific like spare oar tool that I have seen out there.
Wait, Eric, remind me, you tie your spare oar inside your raft, right? You don't typically tie it on the outside?
If I'm tying it on the outside, it's because I'm like last option, however I rigged was ridiculous and I just don't have any choices. But no, for me, for the most part, like my spare oar is going to ideally lay on the deck, you know, inside the oar tower, you know, and just like loosely under a strap or two so that I can basically just move it a little bit and be able to pull it out and go.
Even on a class, like let's say you're doing the Klamath, you would do the same thing on the Klamath? You're probably not going to lose an oar. And if you do, you have plenty of time to get it. You're still going to do that?
Yeah, because you could break an oar anywhere. Like you could be in the middle of having to make a move on a class three rapid where the move is not hard. But if you crabbed your oar at the top or say it already had a crack in it and you pull real hard and it snaps, you're now in like a real serious, you could wrap your boat situation in a place where everyone's going to make fun of you forever because you couldn't get to your spare oar fast enough. Like, it's an easy problem to solve, or it's an easy problem to prevent, I guess, by just putting your oar in a place where you can get to it.
Okay, so this thing, though, puts it on the outside, right?
It does. So it's still easy in a place access. Where, like, if you slam into a wall, I suppose you could still break your oar, but it's higher up. But the big thing is it's accessible. Like, it's right there. It is on the outside, so it can give you a little bit more freedom when you pack. But the big thing for me is it's, like, one little click and your oars in your hand, you're rowing. So, you know, there's no reason to be without an oar for more than like a couple seconds.
Cool. Yeah. You don't have it yet. You're going to try it out at some point.
I don't have it yet, but I want to get one, give it a try, you know, see how it feels. But I've always avoided like all of the different ways, like the things that are made for attaching your oar. Mm-hmm. And this is the first one I've seen where it's like, oh, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I might have to buy that and use it because that makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. So there you have it.
Cool. Emerald, do you want to add gear of the week?
Do you have anything that you just love?
I do, and it's a little bit – I'm going to go for the stretch, and hopefully it still counts as gear. But as someone who often gets hangry on the river, hungry, angry, I think that food is a pretty integral part of my gear. And there's a Idaho guide and gal that lives here in Salmon, Idaho, where I'm based. That has started this company called Orchestra Provisions, and it's basically spices. So, you know, whether you're going for a Cajun spice or an Italian spice, sort of a cinnamon breakfast spice, a more Mexican flavored spice, she blends these spices, but part of the blend is ground up crickets, which sounds just a little too out there. But I gave it a try because she's a friend, and they're actually really good. You can't taste the little ground-up bugs, and they pack a ton of protein in them because crickets are really high in protein. So I think I'm really intrigued by sort of the applications it'll have for those trips outside, you know, whether you're doing some sort of self-support kayak trip or a trip in the mountains. Being able to use this really lightweight, high-quality organic protein source, I think is really intriguing, and I think it'll be interesting to see how it catches on, because I know eating crickets isn't necessarily on the top of everyone's list. But I've been really pleasantly surprised, and I think you can find her stuff. She's just getting started. It's at orchestraprovisions.com. And yeah, I'm kind of into it. I never thought I'd be a bug eater, but here we are.
I'm dying to know how she sources these crickets.
Yeah, that was gonna be my next question. She's like, she going out back like into the field behind the house, and
she just takes a Hell's Canyon trip and goes wild. So I guess there's people that are farming them. There's starting to be a demand, and so there's people that raise crickets explicitly for food. As a food source, and I think she just buys the actual powder directly for them, but they're somewhere in the West. I couldn't quote exactly where they are. It's relatively close by.
So are you buying, is it powder? Do you add to water, or is it a bar? How do you eat it?
Yeah, it's just like a spice mix. So just like you would buy cinnamon or cumin at the grocery store, it's bottled just like that, and you sprinkle it into your food just like you would any dried spice.
So you're adding crickets to your food?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you are.
Like you get some, you know, French toast in the morning, and you want to add a little of the bug cinnamon on top of it for just a little extra sustainability for the day.
Or you're a guide and you're like, every time I eat this damn pancake breakfast, I'm hungry in 2 hours. I'm going to sprinkle some of this delicious cinnamon, cardamom, cricket powder on top, or mix it into the pancakes itself to give it some actual protein and vitamins it wouldn't normally have.
Interesting. Well, I'm fascinated. That sounds intriguing. Because in theory, that right, if it makes the pancake breakfast a little bit more sustainable, then it means I don't have to carry as many bars in my life jacket.
Exactly.
When I'm hungry like an hour later. So.
Yeah, things like those river breakfasts, like pancakes and waffles, they're not that actually good for us. But they're standard river menu. So when we're eating them, you know, almost every day on the river, you're right, it's not the best breakfast for us in terms of keeping us healthy and strong.
Yeah. Got to think of yourself as an athlete out there, because you are.
Awesome. Well, Emerald, thanks for joining us. And Priscilla, sorry we missed you at the end, but I'm sure you're off doing important things, advocating for all of us.
Thank you, Priscilla.
So, thank you, Priscilla, for doing what you do. But yeah, Emerald, thanks for joining us. And yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for listening. Hopefully you were going to the river, coming from the river. There's been water, and then it went away, and it's going to come back, and... yeah, it's boating season, so get out there and listen to us when you're on your way. I guess it's boating season if you're in Oregon. It's snowy season in Idaho.
We went out steelheading on Sunday, so it's officially boating season here, too.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Great. Well, come back next week and listen to the podcast again. All right. I'm on Chattahoochee on Rio Grande, the Alligator.